This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Presented by Fasig Tipton.
But it was all for Shug McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The result will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Now here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
One of the great things about Trainer Talk is that each week we get to visit with so many of the people that make this sport a success, and we get to hear the behind-the-scenes stories of those individuals. And tonight, no exception here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. Welcome to the program, Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, alongside the Pontiff of the Pick Four, Pope Jude, Jude Feld. And we welcome everybody joining us throughout North America on Sirius 219 XM Channel 206, and everyone tuning in worldwide with our live streaming on your computer, smartphone, or mobile device. It's all there for you on our website, horseracingradio.net. JT, we get to make a little history on this program here today. Over the years, we've had the chance to visit with people like Todd Pletcher and Bill Mott and Shug McGahee and Richard Mandela, and that list goes on and on. But we've also had the chance to visit with some people just getting started with their careers that aren't quite the household name in the sport yet. Tonight, completely different scenario. This has never happened on Trainer Talk in the 3 years we've been doing the program.
Yeah, it popped into my head yesterday as I was driving around, and I go, oh man, we need to have this guy on the show. A trainer that's never run a horse before.
Yeah, forget about never won a race. Has never started, never saddled a horse in a race yet in the sport of thoroughbred racing.
He might have saddled a few as an assistant to several prominent trainers.
Yes.
But on his own, with his own name on the program, Friday's going to be the day.
Should be a good one here at Keeneland. That's the grade three Franklin County Stakes. And the name of the trainer joining us tonight is Chris Davis, 27 years old. He's a son of Chicago-based trainer Leanne Davis. And his dad, Herschel, is the assistant starter at Arlington. So racing very much in his pedigree. He has worked for trainers such as Pat Byrne, Mike Stidham, and Phil D'Amato. And tonight he is with us as our special guest on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Chris, welcome to the program, my friend. Thanks for helping us make history.
Oh, thanks for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, looking forward to the visit. And you'll be with us here for the next hour on the program. Never started a horse before on your own. Now, as Jude alluded to, you must have saddled horses for guys like Phil and Mike, but this will be the first time on your own. This is only going to happen. This all happened 2 days here at Keeneland in a graded stakes race.
Yeah.
What's that like, man?
It's unbelievable. I mean, to get your first start here at Keeneland is just an honor enough, but to be have it to be in a grade three, turf race is unbelievable. And to run against trainers like Todd and Graham and, you know, Shug and guys like that and Mike, you know, it's flattering. I'm honored to be there. And, you know, it should be a fun experience.
You think you'll have a few butterflies?
Yeah, probably. I've saddled horses in grade ones before and shipped around all across the country, and I've been doing this a long time. But it's a little different when it's my name, my reputation. I hope you feel you'll run well, and, you know, just as long as she comes back good and tries, that's all that really matters.
You know, a lot of trainers that we've had on this show, they talk about that and the learn by doing method, and the fact that, you know, you can do a lot of things as an assistant and have a lot of responsibility, but it's a whole different kettle of fish when your name's on the program.
Absolutely. I mean, to be an assistant, you know, you're pretty much told what to do. Certain trainers will allow you a little more freedom, but pressure's on when you got to actually make those hard decisions. As an assistant, you can sit there as kind of a third party and be like, oh, we should do this, and this is why. But when it's your name on the program and you're dealing with the clients and the horses themselves and, you know, the help that works for you, it all comes down to you. And it's a lot of pressure. It's a lot of stress. But, you know, it's something that goes with the territory, wanting to be a trainer.
And you've got an outstanding client to start out with, Town and Country, Grade Farm, Breeders' Cup winning outfit. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, I can't thank them enough, Miss Kiki and Shannon Potter, for really giving me this opportunity. They sent a couple horses into Churchill with when I had the string for Phil there, and I improved a couple of them, won one, and you know, it just had a pretty good rapport with them from the beginning. And hopefully we can continue that for a long time. But well, I'm just honored.
Yeah, the name of the horse is My Year is a Day, owned by Town and Country Farm of Kiki Cortellis, and going to start in that Grade 3 Franklin County Stakes, exiting a seventh-place finish at Kentucky Downs in the ladies' sprint. Talk to me about this horse. Tell me the story of My Year is a Day. How'd you come about with this one?
My Year is a Day, Phil D'Amato had her at California when I was out there with him. We shipped her back to run in the ladies' sprint at Kentucky Downs. She didn't run a bad race. Actually, if you look at her form, she only got beat like a length and a half or fourth. It was kind of a blanket finish. The winner went pretty easy. But she's kind of one of those fillies. She's run out of her conditions. You know, she's probably better going about a flat mile, but she's not that grade one kind of caliber filly to run in the first lady. And she didn't run a bad race going 5/8 at Del Mar a year ago. I think they went 56 flat, which they won't go here at Keeneland. So hopefully that 5.5, she'll be still running late. She doesn't have a super turn of foot like you want to see in a really good turf sprinter, but she stays and she's tactically quick. So hopefully she can just stay long enough, pick up the pieces, and finally get that black type that we've been looking for. She's been fourth in a couple stakes in California. You know, she tries every time. So it'll be fun.
He sounds like he's been doing this a while. This is not. It doesn't sound like a guy getting ready to saddle his first horse.
Well, I think he was probably born not too far from a racetrack.
Actually, I wasn't. In fact, I was born in Edmond, Oklahoma, which is right outside Remington Park.
So. Yeah, so this for you is a culmination of a long journey. I mentioned you're only 27 years old, so it's not that long of a journey. But it kind of is, because this is all you ever wanted to do, right?
Yeah. You know, growing up and having my mom train and my dad gallop and work on the starting gate, you know, I was always at the racetrack. You know, from 8 years old, I was allowed to hot walk horses, and then I was learning to put poultice on. And, you know, my dad would let me ride horses back and forth from the track after they train. You know, I wanted to ride when I was 16. My parents obviously didn't let me because, you know, they didn't want me to drop out of high school. So I graduated at 17, went straight to college, graduated college at 20. But through that time, I was still galloping at the racetrack and working and traveling and helping my mom run horses, whether it be Keeneland, Churchill, Ellis, Indiana, Canterbury. You know, just kind of did the whole Midwest circuit.
Where'd you go to college?
NIU. I went to a community college for about a year and a half, and then I got my bachelor's from NIU.
How were you able to balance college and the racetrack life?
Well, you learn when you grow up on the racetrack, it's all hard work and how much you really put into it, and time management. I mean, my parents are extremely hardworking. They do everything pretty much themselves and have horses at the house and raising four kids. I mean, there's no stop. You get up at 4 a.m. and you just go. The same thing, you know, galloping and doing schoolwork.
Yeah, you know, we have a lot of trainers come on the program and talk about, you know, working for their fathers. But, you know, your mom being a trainer and having kids, and how did she balance all of that, getting up at the crack of dawn and having a bunch of kids?
Yeah, four kids, right?
Three sisters. I got a twin sister who actually is a racing official. She works at Arlington. She's in the racing office there, and then she also, I think she's the program coordinator at the fairgrounds. And my two younger sisters, they're not involved with racing as much. But it's hard. I mean, I have more respect for them because doing what they did and, you know, traveling for the winter here and there. And eventually she stopped traveling because it just got too personal and too hard to raise a family the right way and allow us to stay in one school growing up, one house, and not have to pack up and move every 6 months, which is typical on the racetrack. You know, I was very fortunate. Both my parents were there every day growing up. I didn't have to go, oh, I'll see you in 6 months when you come home. So I was fortunate, but they're the two hardest working people I've ever met in my life.
Yeah. Your dad's still a member of the starting gate crew at Arlington, right? He's the assistant starter there, right?
Yeah, he's one of the assistants. He's been there for 27 years, I believe, and has done that. But it's a great spot in Chicago to be an assistant starter because they're union. So we had great health insurance growing up, great benefits for both my parents and our kids. So it was a no-brainer to stay in Chicago. And then growing up there, you had three tracks where you could pretty much run year-round. At one time, you had Sportsman's Park, which is long gone, but Hawthorne and Arlington. And it ran more or less year-round. I think you took 1 month off, I think, in January or February. So that's why they're based out of there. And, you know, growing up, we grew up in a really nice suburb, had a great school system. And it was a great life growing up.
Did you ever try the starting gate thing?
I did, actually. I worked on the starting gate for about a year and a half in Chicago with my dad. And that's just a completely different experience. I mean, to be, you know, you're standing on about a 4-inch piece of aluminum, you know, like a pontoon, and you're strapped to, you know, a 1,200-pound animal that's on tilt, ready to go. And you learn real quick finesse, because if you lock up on them, they're going to hurt you. You know, I got real fortunate. I never got real hurt in there, but I've seen nasty incidences in the starting gate. And those guys, they really are the unsung heroes of the backside or during the races. I mean, they have the jockeys' lives in their hands and the horses. They really don't get paid enough or get enough respect or recognition.
Yeah, I think anybody that's worked on the racetrack, especially trainers, know how important they are. And they're kind of lost in the shuffle with the casual fan. Yeah. But man, oh man, what it's such a thankless job, and it's such an important one. And it's also very dangerous. I mean, you talk about riders being in danger, but those guys are really, they're like in cramped quarters with this massive horse. I mean,
I don't know if I've ever talked to anybody that's worked on the starting gate for a number of years that hasn't had some type of injury, some type of broken bone. It's a lot like when you talk to a rider and they talk about their injuries. Very much the same thing for a starting gate crew member.
Yeah, absolutely. I've seen guys blow out their knees, have horse slick back. Actually, I've almost got kicked in the head. I had a horse flip over and struck at me, and I got lucky she missed. But, you know, horses, when they get scared, they panic, and they'll do one of a few things. But when you're locked in a cage with them, you know, they go either up and back or down and under. And hopefully, you know, you try to keep them as calm as possible.
How wide is the stall in every starting gate?
It's probably about 3.5 feet wide.
Wow. So there's not a lot of room to maneuver there, when you're in there.
You literally have your arm wrapped around a metal pole, and then you're standing on about a 4-inch pontoon.
Wow.
One leg in front of the other.
Not a job for me. There's not enough room in there for me and a horse.
No. But what made your dad want to get into that line of work and focus on that part of the business?
He really liked it. He worked on quarter horses up at Canterbury the first year. I think it was like 85 or 86. And then it was, you know, he'd gallop in the morning. It's just a way to make extra money. He didn't really want to be an assistant or a trainer. It could have been. But he just decided, you know, with the benefits and my mom being relatively successful in the, you know, mid to early 90s, late 90s, that just the health insurance alone was so much of a help.
Sure.
That there was no really reason to stop. And he's got a pension now. I mean, it's 25-year pension. You know, the benefits in Chicago, because there's a big union town. So just the idea of staying there has been great. And then he has, you know, liberty to get on horses for my mom or ship horses and do other things outside of the racetrack on off days. You know, we have four horses at the house, you know, that we got to take care of every day and, you know, kind of stuff like that.
Do you have a favorite story when you think back on what he's done over the years working on the starting gate, being an assistant starter? Is there a favorite story you like to tell about your dad?
I don't think there's a favorite one. I mean, just growing up, like, I used to think it was the coolest thing when I was a little kid to go and watch horses break, you know, because it's like, and then actually being able to do it. The first time I ever broke a horse out of the starting gate, my dad headed me. You know, he was telling me what to do. I was 16, you know, working horses for Richard Hazelton, of all people. You know, guy won over 4,000 races. They used to call him King Richard in Chicago. He used to ship down to Turf Paradise and come back and just own him. But to work for a guy like that when you're young and not really have a clue of what you're doing, and have your dad work in the starting gate, you know, in the morning and say, hey, this is what you're going to do. Have fun. You know, hang on. You know, it's like, and when there is no feeling like a horse breaking out of the starting gate. You cannot, you know, justify that to anybody who hasn't done it.
Yeah, put it into words. Can you do that?
You can't. I mean, like, literally, they drop their hind end and just explode in front of you. But a lot of things can go wrong when they do that. They can trip, they can fall, they can, you know, go left, go right. You can hit another horse, you can lose your iron. You could, like, one of the first times I actually broke out of the gate, the horse broke in, hit the side of the gate, and I lost my stirrup. So I got one foot in the stirrup. I'm riding real short. I finally get my stirrup back. I didn't come off. I thought I was going to, but got lucky there. But a lot of things can go wrong. And that's why you see at the breaks, you see jockeys come off all the time. You see horses hit each other. And you don't grab quarters like California Chrome in the Belmont that one year. You know, a horse stepped out, grabbed his quarter. You know, a lot of things can happen. So,
well, that's the thing in a race too. It's not just about your horse, right? It's like a driver. You worry about yourself, but you worry about the other drivers more, maybe not paying attention or whatever it might be.
Especially in Florida.
Especially in Florida, when they tend to come the other way at you. But same thing in the starting gate, right? You can't control the horses around you and what those other riders are going to do and what those other horses are going to do with those other riders.
Right. I have one horse get the best of me in probably, what was it, 2009? Inez Carlson was riding, I believe it was for Frank Kirby. Horse reared up right at the break. And, you know, you're told when those gates open, you let go. Whether the horse is going backwards, sideways, under, you have to let go because, you know, you're liable. You know, if you don't want to be called, you know, you don't want to be called in the sewers to be like, why did you hold this horse?
Right.
Or, you know, for race fixing or anything else. So, you know, those doors open. That assistant starter's main job is their hands in the air so they don't, you know, get in any trouble. So I had a horse rear up right at the break, about to throw her out the back of the gate, and I'm just standing there with my hands in the air. And, you know, I go watch the replay. Literally, it was at the break. The horse threw its head up, reared up, almost dropped her. There was nothing we can do. And even the starter, Blue Knott, who's been a starter in Chicago for since the mid-80s, he's like, there's nothing you can do. The horse got the best of you. Just bad luck. Yeah. You know, the horse was ruled not a non-starter, which I felt terrible because, you know, a lot goes into trying to get a horse ready to run.
Did the stewards go back and review the tape and take a closer look at that incident?
Yep. They'll do that after every race just about, and especially when one misses the break as bad as it did. But they could clearly see the horse was standing good. The gates open, the horse just reared up, and I wasn't holding on to it. My hand was in the air, so there was nothing they could do to me because I did everything, you know, to the protocol, you know, to the book. You know, it was just bad racing luck.
Sure. Visiting with trainer Chris Davis here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You may not recognize that name, but you might know him quite well after Friday afternoon when he saddles My Year is a Day in the Grade 3 Franklin County Stakes at Keeneland. If you're just joining us, that's going to be his very first starter as a trainer. That's right. He's never started a horse before on his own, but he's worked for some prominent trainers who we're going to talk about throughout the program here and enjoying this visit so far here this morning.
Yeah, I got to ask you, though.
This afternoon, whatever it is.
Being from Chicago, were you happy about the Cubs?
Yeah, what a game. Oh, my God. I don't know how many more ninth inning comebacks they can hold out.
It's tough on a horse trainer to be up till 3 in the morning watching a baseball game.
Yeah, I didn't stay up that late, believe me. I got up and I saw the news. I was like, oh, at least they came back. But they keep doing it this year, so hopefully we finally get the series. That'd be great.
So it is Cubs, not White Sox for you?
Definitely Cubs. Cubs, Blackhawks.
And in Chicago, there's a huge divide there, right?
Oh, absolutely.
It's one or the other.
There's no middle ground. There's no, I go, you know, the old U.S. Cellular, which I think they're going to change the name again, to a Wrigley. I'd rather go to Wrigley 9 times out of 10. No questions asked. You know, Cubs fans are the best. Sorry.
There you go.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll see if they can pull it off.
Yeah.
It'll be a tough series, but.
You were telling us before we went on air, Chris, that you also really enjoy performing and went to school, as a matter of fact, to study some of that.
Yeah, in high school, I was All-State Theater, All-State Tech, which was, it was a big release for me. I've always loved movies and acting, and I think I get that from my mom, she did some TV work growing up and modeling and singing. And it was such a release growing up that, like, I actually wound up, when I started at Medieval Times when I was 15 or 16, I actually started in the sound and lighting department, and then I moved down, and then I became, you know, Squire Knight, and then also assistant horse trainer. There, by the time I was 21.
Medieval Knights, is that like Medieval the jousting?
Times. Yeah.
Medieval Times and the jousting thing?
Yeah, it's a stunt show.
It's cool. Is it a dinner show?
It is.
I went to one of those in Vegas once. It was really cool.
Yeah,
Excalibur.
Yeah. I always wanted to be a knight.
I auditioned for that. I had six buddies of mine actually worked there. And it's funny, I was passing through going to Del Mar like 3 years ago. And I stopped. I'm like, hey, let me come see the show. And my buddy goes, do you want to audition? I'm like, dude, I'm a horse trainer. Like, this is what I'm going to be at the racetrack. He goes, just do it for fun. I'm like, okay. Then actually, as I'm leaving Vegas the next morning, I'm driving down to Del Mar, and I get a phone call from them. They offered me the job. You know, I turned it down because, you know, that time was past. You know, right. I want to be a horse trainer. I want to be in the Hall of Fame. I want to win Grade Ones. I want to win Breeders' Cups, Derbies, you know, Oaks. I would love to win the Arlington Millions. Arlington's still open in a couple of years.
Sure.
But, you know, that's what I want to do. You know, I love performing.
Sorry, so wait a minute. So tell me about another guy coming at you, another knight. You're on horseback, and he's got, what do they call it?
A lance.
A lance coming at you, right? What's that like?
An adrenaline rush. It's like being, the best way I can describe doing that job is like being a professional wrestler, in a sense, because you're fighting you're one of your best friends. You know, it's like a fraternity with all those guys. Very much like being on the racetrack, very tight-knit community, everyone's real close. They all hang out together. Because we work obscure hours, nights and weekends, and then you get the right horses. You know, I got a really good, strong background in like Grand Prix dressage riding, and you know, at medieval times we have Andalusians and Frisians, and they do a lot of Spanish high schooling, which is piaf, passage, a lot of Grand Prix movements of dressage, and to be able to ride like that, and then take that to the racetrack and teach a horse, because I gallop all my own horses. To teach one how to use themselves properly from back to front and how to round up and use their whole bodies and all their different muscles is a big help, you know, for developing, especially a young 2-year-old and getting them to go in the right direction from day one versus not knowing what you're doing or having to pay a rider who is less than mediocre, which happens sometimes because, you know, good riders can't get on every horse at the racetrack. So having that kind of a background is a big help.
Yeah, I don't know if you saw it. There was a... something on Twitter about a trainer, I believe he was Australian, that uses dressage a lot in training his racehorses. And I've heard other trainers talk about that and what a benefit it is to them. And having seen you gallop horses like My Year Is a Day, I know you're very talented in the saddle, so it's all clear to me now.
Yeah, we'll have to get Ken Ramsey with Chris in the paddock one day and tell him that Chris was a knight.
Yeah, that's right.
All Ken Ramsey wants to do is be knighted by the queen.
One time.
He doesn't really think it's going to happen, but he would love for it to happen. And we'll tell him about Chris. And
yeah.
Maybe we can get you a few horses for Ken Ramsey. How would that?
That'd be fantastic. I mean, what a great breeder and what a great racing partnership. And, you know, the job that they do is unbelievable. I mean, they go all over the world and win races, you know, with Wesley to go to Ascot and so on and so forth. And, you know, just to have the Breeders' Cups and Kitten's Joy wins. And, you know, they always seem to have good horses every year. I know they have a lot of horses, but to have the good, you know, the good ones like they do every year, you know, it's unbelievable, and they've been doing it.
You mentioned your mom's success as a trainer. What does she think about you going out on your own and doing this?
Good luck. Why in God's name would you want to do this to yourself? That's actually a quote from her. Because it's not an easy
life. Thanks, Mom.
It's thanks for the confidence. It's not an easy lifestyle, you know, with the moving, especially in the Midwest, East Coast. You're constantly moving from circuit to circuit, you know, track to track. It's very hard to have a life outside of work. And then also to pick up clients and pick up horses and then to have them keep the horses sound and keep the owners happy and keep your help happy and pay all your bills and make sure your clients pay you. It's not an easy lifestyle, and a lot goes into it, and there's a lot of stress and a lot of, you know, things to worry about other than just the horses. From a business standpoint too. And starting out, you know, you take a big hit because you got to buy all your own tech. You got to buy all your own signs, blankets, you know, you got to pay for your help. You got to just do everything more or less yourself. You know, it's stressful. And, you know, if you don't make it, you can get burned pretty bad.
How'd you know the time was right to do this on your own?
When you have a farm like Town and Country approach you and have the horses that they do and the quality and have that name behind you and to be able to pick up, you know, some allowance horses and especially a stake horse, before you even make your first start is kind of an opportunity people wait for. And, you know, I'd like to have a couple more in the barn right now, but to have the quality that I do, it's just an unbelievable head start and have the connections and then just the name behind you. I mean, they won the Breeders' Cup last year. I mean, to have an owner that's already been to the big dance and have won, you know, like they have, to have them backing you and say, hey, we trust you to have our horses that we pay a lot of money for to, you know, it's just, it means the world.
Yeah, because I also have horses with Todd Pletcher. So
yeah,
that's a nice little feather in your cap.
Todd and Phil D'Amato, Phil's leading trainer. We won, you know, the last three major meets. He won the two Santa Anita meets in Del Mar. I mean, he's rolling. So to have guys, you know, to be kind of put in that category with Todd and Phil, you know, before I've even done anything is unbelievable. And I'm so flattered and honored, really.
you know, you talk about the business end of it, and that's another one of the beauties of having a client like Town & Country starting out, because you know you're going to get your check.
Absolutely.
I've always said trainers should charge first and last. I mean, if you go to rent an apartment, you pay first and last, and now somebody gives you a horse, and it costs you $4,000 a month to train their horse.
Mm-hmm.
So if they don't pay you for the first month, right? If it's 30 days before they pay you, now you've got $8,000 into that horse, and it might not even be worth $8,000.
It might not be. And then not only that, you got your payroll, your help, and then you got to take care of yourself. You got to pay your own rent. You got to pay your own food, gas, so on and so forth. So you got to have a little money behind you, saved up to go. But I'm pretty fortunate because I can do everything myself at this stage in the game. Like, I get on all my own, so I don't have to pay a rider $20 a head to come over and get on one every day. I could save some of that money and put it all back into, my wallet, because I'll be paying myself more or less. But when you get bigger, and hopefully that money continues to trickle in, you get enough good clients that are good pay, and then you pick up grooms and hot walkers, and then you start, gradually growing.
Where are you going to base your operation?
I'd like to base in Kentucky. Kentucky for, most of the year, and then New Orleans for the winter. New Orleans is a good safe fit for me. I've been there I spent 5 winters there. They have turf racing, and you don't have to go compete against Chad or Todd in Gulfstream, and you don't have to go to California and, kind of put yourself on an island out there. And then also you got Oaklawn, it's like 7.5 hours from New Orleans for big, big, purses. And then you got, Houston for some steaks. You can go get steak place pretty easily. It's just a good central hub. You're not far from anywhere. It's easy to get in and out of, versus being in Miami, which you're all the way down south, and then California. And then if you go to Oaklawn, then you don't have a turf track. So to me, New Orleans is a no-brainer.
Is it challenging for a young trainer like yourself just getting started to get stalls when you go to a major racetrack like that?
Absolutely.
How does that work?
Well, you have to put a stall app in. Every trainer does. But racing secretaries and stall men are kind of hesitant to give you exactly what you need, because they don't know if you can fill them right away. And they don't want trainers to sit there and be like, here, Chris, here's 10 stalls. Well, if I show up with 5 horses, and there's other trainers like Asmussen or Stidham that go down there, and they're looking for more stalls because they have the horses and the numbers, you kind of get screwed, because you need to be able to fill your stalls. But if you don't have enough stalls for the horses that you already have or have coming in, you kind of put yourself in a bind too. And I, having a good rapport with Scott Jones, who's the assistant racing secretary in New Orleans, and Jason, who's the racing secretary, and Mario, who's a stall man, they know I'm not going to ask for more than what I need. They know I'm going to do my best to fill them. And if not, I don't mind helping other people out who need to borrow, which, when you work in big operations such as, Phil or Todd or any major operation in the country, every assistant knows how to beg, borrow, and steal stalls, from a day-to-day basis. Because one day you'll be sitting there, you'll get a call from a van agency, hey, you got 5 showing up. You might have 2 empty stalls, so you got to go find 3 for those horses. And you make a lot of friends and enemies kind of doing that, but more friends, because everyone wants to help each other out for the most part.
We're visiting with trainer Chris Davis here on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton. We're going to get to a short commercial break. We'll come back, and we're going to talk about some of the people that helped him along the way, not just his parents, but people like Mike Stidham and Phil D'Amato and even Pat Byrne. We'll talk about that in the second half of the show. Stay with us. Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton.
The Fasig Tipton November Sale. The world's premier breeding stock event annually posts the highest average and median of any mixed sale in the world. In 2015, broodmares averaged 3 times more than the nearest competitor, and racing and broodmare prospects averaged 5 times more, with weanlings selling for as high as $600,000. The Fasig Tipton November Sale, November 7th in Lexington, Kentucky. Nominate today at FasigTipton.com.
Bloom Racing.
Majestic City could also still do it, and here he comes.
Majestic City running a big one.
Started by former jockey and 35-year racing industry veteran Jeffrey Bloom, Bloom Racing offers racing partnerships, bloodstock services, pin hooking, and private race management.
Soul Driver the leader, though. Soul Driver in front.
Experience the fun, excitement, and exclusive access of racehorse ownership with Bloom Racing. Forming racing partnerships now. Get in on the action at bloomracing.com.
It all started with a dream to be the best. To breed the best. To race the best.
Super Saver Ross O'Brien, what a finish to the class.
And to stand the best. Windstar Farm, dedicated to the dream.
Maryland Breds are your formula for success. Be part of a breeding program in a state which offers competitive purses, 30% breeder bonuses, 30% owner bonuses, and year-round racing backed by state legislators creating pro-breeding and racing legislation, all supported by a working cooperative between the racetracks, horsemen, and breeders. It's time to own a Maryland Bred. Better stallions, better mares. Maryland Breds. Learn more at MarylandThoroughbred.com.
This is Trainer Talk on HRRN, presented by Fasig Tipton.
And welcome back to Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Mike Penna, Jude Feld in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, continuing our visit with trainer Chris Davis, and a really enjoyable first half of the show. Looking forward to the second half of the program as well. We'll do that next, right after we remind you that you can always get great purses, world-class amenities, and an extended racing season. Well, those are just a few of the things you can get when you run your horse at Woodbine Racetrack. Woodbine offers a premier experience to all friends of the horse racing community and is committed to innovation, playing host to over 130 live racing days in 2016 and 2017, with an average of over $500,000 offered in purses daily. The meet starts in spring and concludes in early December, and you can't do better than running your horse at Woodbine Racetrack. You'll get access to world-class trainers, a modern backstretch, great training surfaces, and so much more. So why not share in the profit by racing at Woodbine? To start your racing journey, visit woodbineentertainment.com/due north. That's woodbineentertainment.com/due north. And don't forget that if you missed any portion of this program or any of our Trainer Talk shows, head over to our website, horseracingradio.net. Check out a podcast of this program and all of our shows, all there for you. Horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Well, some good stuff from Chris Davis in the first half of the show, talking about getting started. If you're just joining us, he'll be starting his very first horse at Keeneland this coming Friday in the Grade 3 Franklin County Stakes. And you think about starting your first horse in a graded stake, that's remarkable enough. But to have a trainer on this program that's never started a horse is new for us, and we couldn't be more thrilled to be visiting with Chris here tonight. All right, Chris, we talked about some of the trainers that have helped you along the way. Of course, your mom and dad, both instrumental in your success so far. But you talk about names like Mike Stidham and Phil D'Amato. We mentioned Pat Byrne. Walk us through the progression and some of the trainers you've had the chance to be around.
Well, you know, I started when I was about 16. I worked for, you know, Richard Hazleton. The guy won over 4,000 races in his career. He's unbelievable. You know, old school to the T, you know, kind of trial by fire when, you know, he's letting a 16-year-old kid get on his horses who didn't know much. And he, you know, took me under his wing. He showed me a lot. A lot of Chicago-based trainers over the winters and, you know, at Hawthorne. And, you know, then I worked for, you know, Wayne Catalano was probably my first major job on the racetrack. I was riding the pony and galloping for him. And, you know, watching a big operation and watching a trainer like Wayne, who's won, you know, multiple Breeders' Cups races, you know, Triple Crown races. He's been on top of his game for a long time. And I mean, got nothing but respect for Wayne. I mean, the guy won almost 1,800 races as a jockey. And he's won over 2,000 as a trainer. You know, the guy's lived, breathed racing for his whole life. And the knowledge and watching the way he treats his horses and watch, you know, the detail that goes into his operation is really remarkable. And, you know, then from there, I started, you know, I galloped for Pat Byrne for a while. You know, I galloped Take Charge Indy for him, which, you know, he ran the Kentucky Derby and he won the Florida Derby a couple of years ago. And now he stands at Windstar. And to be around horses like him, you know, that was fun. And Pat, you know, he's won the Classic. You know, he trained Awesome Again and, you know, had a lot of horses and used to be a real big top trainer, you know, back in the day. And then, you know, working as an assistant for like Mike Stidham and Phil D'Amato, you know, Mike is meticulously organized. He runs probably the tightest show I've ever worked in as a barn when it comes from cleanliness all the way down to grooms and, you know, showing up on time. There is no room for error. There's not an inch given. for anybody, whether it be Mike himself, Hillary, his main assistant, who's been there for 15 years, down to the hot walkers. You know, everyone is expected to do their job and do it well. And if not, you can leave. Go right back out the door you came in. And then working, you know, making the move to transition to California to work with Phil D'Amato, who's a young up-and-coming trainer, you know, who was an assistant for Mike Mitchell for many years. We're, you know, a little bit back here, but predominantly in California, to watch the difference between the East Coast and West Coast training and to learn from a guy who has built or had an incredible amount of success in a short amount of time to win three training titles in pretty much what the first 3 years of his career is remarkable. And stand-up guy, great operation, and treats his horses better than most. And just the amount of success and watching people go through their day-to-day motions, whether, you know, they're more of the business, more of the horseman, everyone kind of has their own niche. And to take a little bit away from everybody you work for is, I think, is a big key, because most assistants do, you know, you find what you like in a trainer, you find what you don't like in a trainer. Then as you go on your own, you can kind of mold what you want or what you see works and what you see doesn't work.
So what do you see yourself taking away from each of those trainers?
Mike, organization, cleanliness, you know, it's a huge key. Everything needs to look professional, presentable. Everything needs to be on time, clean. Phil, you know, aggressive in the entries, you know, pushes the envelope to where, you know, you better have horses in that race to beat him. You know, there's not very many races where Phil's in that where he's not 8-5 or 9-5. Wayne, just the horsemanship, you know, being there every day. You know, you're in the barn at, you know, 4:30 every single day and looking at your horses. You know, if you want to be the best, you got to work. You know, Todd Pletcher's the same. I mean, you sit there, you can be across from him every day. You will never beat him to the barn. There are certain guys that you watch their success and you want to be envious, but bottom line, can you outwork them? I mean, these guys reach that level for a reason. It's not because they're lucky or it's not because, you know, they have just good horses. It's bottom line, they've put the work in for years and years and years and getting up and busting your butt.
Wayne Lucas still doing it.
Yeah, Wayne. Yeah. I mean,
you can't beat him to the
barn. He's in the barn 10-4. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's funny. I was laughing.
Some mornings even a little earlier.
Yeah, there is I went to Pimlico a few years ago. I think it was the Oxbow one, the Preakness. And he actually opened the racetrack by himself and trained his horse 15 minutes before the track actually opened. And security's running down thinking they're going to yell at somebody. And it was Wayne. And they're like, Mr. Lucas, the track's closed. He goes, well, you guys are late. And basically he was 10 minutes early for the track, and 10 minutes early to him is right on time. So
great story.
I mean, he's a machine. You know, he still gets on his pony every day, and watching guys like that, you know, from Churchill and, you know, going to New York and California, these guys, you know, Bob Baffert and, you know, Richard Mandela, and, you know, these guys I idolize. You know, I want to beat them, and I want to beat them every time, but I idolize them because they put the work in. They're great horsemen. They're good businessmen. You know, they're respectable. They do a good job.
You know, I know you respect, Chris, every single trainer that you've been around. And when you listen to you talk, you know that you have a respect for the game too. But if you could emulate one trainer and say, this is who I want to be someday, this is my guy, who would it be?
It'd probably be a combination of, like, Todd Pletcher, just from the sheer numbers and winning as many grade ones as he does. And a combination of Chad Brown for having all the grass horses. I love turf horses. And he does an exceptional job with his. You know, Richard Mandela, you know, for developing a horse over their career, such as like Beholder. I mean, the guy's won how many Breeders' Cups in one day? I mean, just the class of him. And like, I was actually a few years ago, I got to ship into his barn with a horse and watch him. I mean, He's no spring chicken. He's been around the game forever, but he still puts his blacksmith apron on. He'll pull a shoe off. He'll look at a horse. He's checking legs every day. You know, guys like that from the horsemanship aspect, and guys like Mike Stidham, you know, business oriented, very good, very aggressive entering, good claiming trainer, good stake trainer, you know, very analytical when it comes to, you know, Ragusan sheets and, you know, form, you know, buyers and claiming and just, you know, stuff like that. You can take stuff away from everybody, but I'd love to be a combination of, like, obviously Todd, Chad, you know, Mike, Richard Mandela, all those guys, like a melting pot.
That would help get you to your goal of being in the Hall of Fame that you mentioned earlier.
It would.
No doubt about it.
I hope I'm alive to give you your introduction.
Hopefully.
Get there quickly.
I plan
yeah,
on
yeah, really.
I'm going to try.
Clock's it's just, ticking.
It's all about, you got to, but again, you know, there's guys that win, you know, thousands of races in their career, but they'll never make the Hall of Fame because they don't have that big horse. You know, it doesn't take, it's not just winning thousands upon thousands of races. It's winning the big races on the big days, you know, when all the chips are down, you got to run for those $1 million, you know, Breeders' Cups and, you know, the Derbies and, you know, all the Triple Crown races and Grade Ones throughout the country. You know, you can win 4,000 races, but if you're a claimer, you're probably not going to make the Hall of Fame. You know, you got to surround yourself with good horses and good clientele. That's the thing that separates some of those really big guys from, you know, some of the little guys that people really don't know is the stock. If me and you are in a car race, I'm in a Ferrari and you're in a Prius, for instance, I'm going to win every time, you know, just because you could be, you know,
I'm taking you out at the start.
You could be Mario Andretti, you know,
I'm Dale Earnhardt, over on you at the start,
Dale,
by the way.
Or Dale Earnhardt Jr. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a better driver, but if I have a faster car, I'm probably going to win the race.
Right.
It just, you know, and that's the way horse racing is.
Well, that's what jockeys tell us too. It's what's underneath you that gives you the confidence. And it every good jockey will tell you it's the horses that I'm getting.
Absolutely.
On. Yeah.
And Charlie Whittingham, you know, a lot of people have said, oh, you know, he wasn't that great a trainer. He never won 100 races in a year, but they don't remember that most of the time he was training 40 horses.
Yeah.
He wasn't training 300.
Exactly.
And the other thing that he always used to say is, I may not win as many races as some people, but I win the important ones.
Right.
And that was his key. I mean, he was always looking at the stakes book because those are the kind of horses that he had.
I mean,
once in a while, you know, he'd have maidens that he would develop along the way that, you know, were very well-bred maidens. But by and large, you know, his horses were always in the top races. And that's why even to this day, he holds records in California for the number of stakes that he's won.
Visiting with trainer Chris Davis on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. How many horses would you like to have if you could set the number?
Depends. I think 50, anywhere from 50 to 60 is a really good number. Because you'll have options to run. You want to, as a trainer, you want to be seen running as often as you can. That's the only way to continue to generate business. So you don't want to go stagnant. And then also, the more horses you have, the more chances you have of having a good one or finding, you know, the kind of the diamond in the rough that's going to be your next superstar. You know, if you get 10, 12 horses a year, the likelihood of you finding, you know, a Grade One winner and those 10 horses is slim to none. I mean, realistically. So obviously, the more influx of stock you have, the better chances you're going to have to find those better horses and the quality of horses.
Do you see yourself going to the sales eventually, maybe picking out yearlings or two-year-olds in training or things like that?
Absolutely. I mean, that's where you generate a lot of business because you get to meet, you know, owners usually go to sales, and some owners will actually pick out their own horses. And then also bloodstock agents. You build rapport with bloodstock agents who have the clients. You know, if you become friends with a couple of them, they might throw you a horse here and there, and you never know. You know, if you pick up a horse for, like, say, you know, Benny Glass, who does a lot of buying and selling for Mary and Gary West, you never know what you're going to get. And it's all about getting the lucky breaks at the right time with the right clientele. I mean, that'll make or break somebody's career.
Our whole game is based on relationships with jockey agents, mm-hmm. and you know, bloodstock agents and owners and your fellow trainers. I used to get some really nice horses from Bobby Frankel that he didn't have room for, that for me they were great, for him they were like the bottom of his barn, but still, I mean, that was fantastic for me. And Arnold Winnick used to take care of my brother and I when I first started. He would send us horses to rehabilitate, and then we'd get them fixed up and send them to Randy. And those relationships that you have with people, they can last a lifetime, or, you know, at least your whole career. And it's so important, you know, to be respectful and to develop those relationships.
Yeah, even having the respect of other trainers, like whether it be, you know, me working for Phil in California, to where if he sends something back east, you know, I'd hope that I'm the top name on his list for a recommendation. You know, trainers get fired all the time, you know, for one reason or another. You know, I just hope that I'm going to be the name that people recommend, because that just means they respect me and they respect the job I do. And they know I'm going to take good care of their horses, and they know I'm going to run them aggressively and try to win to the best of my ability. So a lot of it's, you know, you got to have the respect of your peers, you know, because if you don't, you know, people talk, people will always talk and people always look at you. So you want to be well respected and do a good job and keep, you know, a clean, tight ship, because everything reflects on you.
You know, as we touched on earlier, Chris, you're a young guy, 27 years old. We always hear that racing doesn't do a good enough job of attracting young people to the sport. Obviously, you were attracted from a very young age. I was attracted from a young age. Jude, this is all he's ever done is work in the business. So for us, it's easy to understand right. What's so great about this game. When you talk to young people about the sport, what do you tell them?
Oh, I mean, I do agree that we do not do enough for young people. I wish there was more ways to get all the good stories that happen on the backside on a daily basis out, because it always seems like everyone wants to show the negative, either a horse, you know, breaking down fatally and, you know, so on, like with stuff like that. But there are so many stories of rehoming horses. For instance, my mom had a horse that was shortlisted for the Olympics for eventing this year. You know, stuff like that, that are like, even the people, like on a daily basis, I mean, this is a whole industry where people get up, you know, thousands of people get up 7 days a week to go in and take care of these animals. And I would put up care of a racetrack horse, a thoroughbred, over any show horse in the country for the most part, because they're getting grubbed on every day. They're getting sanded bandages on. They're only getting the best feed. You know, these are professional athletes. And it's really horrible when people try to villainize the sport. So when I talk to young people, you know, you get them in, you show them. And I always like, especially coming to Keeneland, because it's a college town. There's a lot of young kids that come out to Keeneland. Well, the great thing about Keeneland is there's not a stable gate. Most racetracks in the country, an average person can't get back and see the horses. So they have no idea what's going on behind the, you know, the gates with the barbed wire wrapped around it and the, you know, the sealed barns. But at Keeneland, people are allowed to walk through the barn area.
Is that good or bad?
To me, it's a catch-22, because bad things can happen. You know, horses can bite people. You know, people can give horses stuff. However, it's great because I love to sit there and talk to people about the sport. You introduce them to horses. You tell them kind of backstories about them. You tell them about their personalities. You know, you try to show them the good side of racing. You know, you tell them stories about, oh yeah, this horse won a race, and when he came back, he was on cloud nine. He pranced all the way around. You know, you can really see it in his face that he won. And when you watch those horses develop from a young age and watch what they do and watch how much they love it to compete, and when they win, I mean, there's nothing like it. And people that don't see it on a daily basis, like we get to on the backside, they don't understand it. You know, these horses know what they're doing, and the good ones know that they're good. And actually, that's why you'll see horses go on a roll and win 6 or 7 or 8, like Tenpin, you know, who just lost her, you know, first race out of 9.
Yeah.
But to watch one like that that really loves it is unbelievable. And to get young people in it that, you know, it's hard, because it does take a lot of money to get into the sport. But I do know a lot of friends that like to gamble. You know, I know a lot of friends that like just like horses, and I know a lot of friends that like to, you know, bet on certain jockeys or, you know, stuff like that. So just getting them into the backside and showing them the horses and kind of give little backstories is huge.
Yeah, breaking down we call it the intimidation factor of what racing's all about. People, I think, have that stereotype. It's the sport of kings. You have to be a rich person to be around it. That's not the case anymore. Yeah, there's a lot of very wealthy people involved in the sport, but that's not the case. You can get involved with racing on the ownership side in a partnership, not spend a lot of money. But even from a fan perspective, there are so many opportunities now to come out and be educated. And there's so many people like yourself, Chris, and Jude and I, that have the opportunity to take new people out to the track and let them experience all of the good things and the positive things that this sport has to offer.
Yeah, there's no question about it, and you're right. I mean, there's so many great things that happen on the backside every day, and you know, Saratoga Special does a great job of promoting that at Saratoga. But you know, it'd be great if we had a Saratoga Special at every track.
Yeah,
I'm sure Sean Clancy would approve.
Yeah, honestly, that's why we started this program to bring you behind the scenes and talk about some of the positive stories and the backstories of trainers. Jock Talk on Tuesday night is another program that we host with the stories of jockeys, very much in the same way of thinking as what you're talking about, promoting those positive stories that we have in the sport.
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything else, you know, with negativity, you know, there's a lot of money involved, and people, you know, there's always extremists on each side, you know, of the fence. You know, these horses are bred to do this, and most of them like it. Not all of them are as talented as others, but most of them like to do it. And to have, you know, to literally to show somebody that a horse is happy and sound and likes to run is really hard. And there's always people that want to push an envelope too hard. And, you know, you see bad things all the time. But we really should show the good things.
Which are the majority of things. The positives completely outweigh the negatives in the sport of thoroughbred racing. Unfortunately, mainstream media will focus much more on the negatives because they want the story.
Exactly.
And that's going to sell. But absolutely, it doesn't sell, you know, for us anyways. It doesn't sell.
Yeah, well, you know, the thing is, people in our game understand, you know, horses, and but we have people all the time that say, how do you know a horse is happy, you know?
And happy horses.
And it, for me, it's like second nature. Like, I'm sure it's
like
it is
looking
for you.
At a dog.
Right.
Dog yeah. wags his tail, always happy.
Right. And I've had people say to me, how do you know which horse is which? You know, like, well, how do I know you're Chris and you're Mike?
You know, they look.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, for some reason, horses get lumped into a horse, you know, and all those little nuances, I call it horsonality now, because they're not people, but they have their own traits, and they, you know, look at you a different way. And I loved it when you said, you know, the horse wins a race, comes back, and he's all happy and pumped up. You know, that, I mean, that's, you can see that when you're with him every day. It's just like when you're with your dog and you take him to the park and he's running around and he's all excited, you know, you would know that about your dog. So why wouldn't you know that about your horse?
Can you feel that when you're galloping your horses in the morning, if a horse is indeed happy, or maybe the opposite of that, where he's like, hey, this isn't my thing today, I'm just not in the mood?
Absolutely. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've been sitting on a horse to where you come back and look at the trainer and be like, he's ready. I don't care where you run him, just run him. Because they're peaking. We call it peaking. A horse just gets to doing so good. They're sound. They're happy.
And you can feel that.
Oh, absolutely. And then you can also feel when they're kind of tailing off or they back up. They're just not, they kind of get lethargic and not wanting to do it. So then, you know, as an exercise rider, you can walk to your trainer, because sometimes if the trainer doesn't get on him or doesn't see him all the time, you know, whether they have multiple strings, you know, call the assistant or do. And as a good exercise rider, should always suggest something about the horse, because they're getting on them. They really do know them as good, if not better, than anybody else, because you learn their idiosyncrasies. You learn from a day-to-day standpoint on how they're going, whether, you know, how they're made. They might not always look smooth. They might go a little rough. But from a day-to-day standpoint, you know how they are and how they're going to progress. And, you know, a trainer should respect what exercise riders should have to say about a horse, because they're getting on them and they know. You know, I'm not saying that every exercise rider is right, but you got to take into consideration, hey, you know, he's a little lethargic today. Maybe just look at him either with the vet, or just pull him out on the road and jog him and just kind of see what's going on, or, you know, pull blood on him, you know, if he's quiet, or, you know, stuff like that. There's so much that goes into it, and trainers are as good as their help. Really, that's why you want to have the best help, good riders, good grooms, good hot walkers. It's a really big team effort. You know, you can be the name on the barn, but you're not going to rub 50 horses yourself. You're not going to ride 50 horses yourself. You're going to have a team of people that you trust to do the job with you. It really, and like Doug O'Neill says it the best, everything is Team O'Neill. You know, it really is. You know, for him, it's a massive team. It's a big team effort, and in just about every major barn in the country.
When you were working for Pat Byrne, you told me you had a chance to gallop Take Charge Indy for him. Could you tell when he was peaking and ready to go?
Absolutely. You could tell what he was when you first sat on him. And he, like with him, the way he would gallop, his stride was so big and he was so strong as a two-year-old. But he had such a great mind. And that's 90% of the game also, is how a horse's brain is working. And we call it class. You can see a horse that gets real nervous and real wound up in the morning, and horses that just go out there and just cool as can be, you know, just they mature faster than some of their peers. It's kind of like seeing a kid in, you know, middle school that's going to shoot the 6 foot tall, and then in freshman high school, that's as tall as that kid's ever going to get. You know, some horses peak before others. But like even like when I galloped, I had the privilege of getting on Animal Kingdom as a two-year-old for Wayne Catalano at Arlington. And I'll never forget the first day I ever got on him. I looked at Wayne and I said, is he three? He goes, no, he's two. Why? I said, this horse is something special. He goes, really? I'm like, the horse is nice. And, you know, going on to watch that horse, you know, win the Derby and then the Dubai World Cup and, you know, stuff like that. It's fun to watch him develop, even though I wasn't riding him at the time. But just the fact that getting on him as a two-year-old and kind of having a gauge, be like, wow, this horse.
What did he do that made you think he was going to be so nice?
Just the way he moved, the way he felt underneath you. He was so big and he was so strong. It felt like he was breathing something different than others. And Wayne had a bunch of horses that year. And you could always, you just tell. I mean, like getting on a horse, like obviously for Phil, or Wilcox in for Mike Stidham, or, you know, like Tate Charge Indy. You get around them and you know what you have. Like I had Her Eminency with me in California from the time she was 3/8 of a mile fit. You know, she won first time out at Del Mar. She was second in the grade one debutante and she won the $100,000 Surfer Girl. You know, I told Mike that this was probably the nicest fillies he's had in a while. And she was. I mean, just the way she would move, the way she acted, you know, the ability in her breezes in the morning. You know, they're all indicators of, you know, what there could potentially be.
Talking with trainer Chris Davis on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Chris, only about 3 minutes or so left. We mentioned at the top of the show, actually mentioned it a couple of times throughout the program, that on Friday you will saddle your first horse of your career on your own. I know you've done it for other trainers, but on your own. And it's going to happen in a grade three race at Keeneland. And boy, we want to wish you all the best with that one, my friend. That's going to be a very special moment for you.
Yeah, it's going to be something that I'll never forget. You know, I might even frame the overnight. I actually have it folded sitting in the car. Keep the program, keep the overnight. Maybe I'll put it in a frame somewhere, put it away.
I know that feeling. It's a good feeling.
Will you be able to sleep the night before?
I hope so. I mean, I think there's a lot of pressure, you know, and hopefully everything goes great. And, you know, if everything goes great, she'll win. I could start my career tenfold. But most importantly, as long as the horse runs her race and comes back healthy, that's all I care about. And for me, it's just another day at the office. I mean, I've run barns for people. I've had my own strings of horses where the trainer wasn't there. So, you know, when I had those horses on my own, I felt like I was the trainer. You know, yes, I had contact with the trainer just about every day and we, you know, went back and forth on what we were going to do with them. But 90% of it, I got to make those calls, from a day-to-day standpoint. And, you know, I took it like they were my own. So this really is, you know, yes, my first one, but to me, it's just another day.
Well, and the name of the horse is My Year is a Day, and it could be quite a day for trainer Chris Davis on Friday afternoon at Keeneland. So if you want to pay attention to that one and keep an eye on him and then go out and tell Chris that you heard him right here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Chris, we always like to wrap it up in the final minute or so by asking trainers what else they like to do outside of horse racing. So any other hobbies, habits that you enjoy doing, sports, anything like that?
Yeah, I like, I go to movies a lot. And I play pool with a couple friends of mine pretty often. I like to sleep. getting up 7 days a week at 4 o'clock in the morning, it gets rough. So sleep is a big hobby of mine.
If it was easy, everyone would do it.
That's right. Trainer nap.
Well, Chris, thanks so much for taking the time to be with us here today. A really enjoyable visit. All the best moving forward, especially on Friday, but then moving forward from there too. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on. I really appreciate it.
All right, Chris Davis here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Don't forget, we're edging closer to the Breeders' Cup World Championships. We are your exclusive home here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Check out a complete Breeders' Cup Week schedule, horseracingradio.net, and follow us all the way down that road at horseracingradio.net. And by the way, a podcast of this show available on our website too. Head over and check it out. Been fun.
Yeah, great show.
All right, for our producer, Lee Delapina, for our special guest, Chris Davis, for Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna, and we will talk to you next week right here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Thanks for listening.